Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 23rd of April. It's All Things Political, which you always hear Mondays at 9 here on the Ideas Network. We have a lot to talk about. The Supreme Court is taking up Arizona's strict immigration statute this week. We'll be looking at Mitt Romney's potential vice presidential choice. Our guest this hour thinks he knows who it's going to be. We will look at, I think we'll talk a little bit about John Edwards, too, who has really fallen, and we'll look at that trial. The White House is dealing with a scandal involving the Secret Service. We will talk about that. Yesterday, the U.S. completing a draft of a partnership agreement with the Afghan government. Troops will leave in 2014, but American support continuing until 2024, which is a long time. What will they be doing? So that's just a few of the things that I thought we would talk about. But of course, you are welcome to join our conversation. We have a great guest with us this hour. Major Garrett will be with us, White House correspondent for National Journal. He was a reporter for Fox News for a number of years, where he was chief White House correspondent. 8 years at Fox, covered Congress, two presidential elections, the war in Iraq, and other issues. He was also a White House correspondent for CNN, covering Presidents Bush and Clinton, senior editor before that, and congressional reporter for U.S. News and World Report. So he has been around the block. Our phone number for you to join our conversation for all things political is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. And if you'd like to use the Facebook page to leave comments either on the air or just for other listeners to chat with them as the show is going on and after the show, that's the Kathleen Dunn Show, and that's at Facebook. Major Garrett, hello.
Good morning. It's great to be with you.
Well, it's great to be with you. Did you get snow?
No. No snow. Lots of rain, but no snow. So my old men's baseball league game was rained out yesterday.
Well, at least it wasn't snowed out, right? That would have been
exactly.
A lot worse. I'm glad you played baseball. That's a nice thing to do there in Washington. Well, it's a busy week. Let's start with the Supreme Court taking up Arizona's immigration statute. A couple questions. What are they looking at? And the second question is how the presidential campaigns are going to deal with this issue that we never seem to be able to take on in any substantial way.
Right. It's been a huge and cutting federal issue for the better part of a decade. And now the Supreme Court is going to weigh in on two different issues. One, a very broad constitutional question, which is this. Is immigration law defined and enforced by the federal government, or can states under duress with particular circumstances that they say require them to intervene to protect their citizens, protect their border, protect their own state sovereignty, are they allowed to create laws for themselves within the immigration construct of federalism? Meaning, can states do things on immigration, or are they disallowed because immigration is by definition, according to the court, a federal responsibility and solely a federal responsibility? That's a broad constitutional question. Then there are four intimate parts of the Arizona law that go to other underlying protections in the Constitution that the Supreme Court's going to look at. Basically, there are two provisions in the Arizona law that say if you're an illegal immigrant in Arizona, by definition, you've committed a crime. Mm-hmm. And then there's also a means by which, using a very broadly defined definition of probable cause, you can be stopped and have your request made by law enforcement for your documentation, your papers, in other words. Well, all four of those provisions of the Arizona law strike Hispanic groups, civil libertarians, as an overreaching of state power to say, wait a minute, you look like you might be an illegal. Well, what does that mean? What does it mean to look like you might be illegal? Is that simply a racial kind of distinction that is drawn by law enforcement? Is it because you're in a certain neighborhood, or it's because you drive a certain kind of car? What's the underlying foundation for probable cause to say, well, you might be here illegally, therefore I have the legal right to stop you and demand to see your documentation? So the court is going to look at those finer grain aspects of the Arizona law, and then also the big question, can states do this? Because it's not just Arizona. South Carolina, Alabama, Louisiana, other states have passed laws like this, and about 15 others are moving in this direction. So whatever the court decides on that broad question, plus the intimate aspects of the law, will be very far-reaching.
Major Garrett, why is it so hard for Republicans and Democrats, both of whom see this as a meaningful issue, an important issue in this country, and yet we don't seem to make any headway on it? We just can't figure out what to do.
Well, there's a couple of reasons. And unlike a lot of issues in Washington that I've covered in the last 10 or 15 years where there's a partisan alignment and it's a rigid partisan alignment and you don't see much shifting, this issue has seen some shifting. Your audience may well remember President George W. Bush, in his second term, laid it on the line on behalf of comprehensive immigration reform, as he described it, worked hand-in-hand with a lot of Democrats to try to get that issue settled once and for all, to create a system of verification of documentation if you had a job in this country, to increase border protection, border security, and to provide a way, a long-distance way, many years in the making, for people who are here illegally to obtain first resident status and then citizenship status. Mm-hmm. Well, there was such an uprising on the right wing of his party that Republicans backed away from that, and the president could not succeed. So he tried the bipartisan route, and it didn't work. Even as a Republican president with a Republican Congress, he couldn't succeed. And that failure has left Republicans believing that they have to assert a posture and a position that border security has to be defined and implemented fully to their satisfaction before they will deal with any of the other internal immigration issues. Well, as long as that's the approach Republicans are going to take, and they can block things with preventing a 60-vote majority in the Senate, there's not going to be any movement on immigration until they are satisfied on the border security side of the question. Meanwhile, Democrats and the Obama administration, if you look at the statistics, the Obama administration has deported far more illegal immigrants than the Bush administration did. And they've only been in office for 3 years, so more in 3 years than the Bush administration did in 8 years. So they're trying to tell Republicans, look, we're serious, more serious than your Republican president about deportation, so why don't you deal with us a little bit more constructively on immigration? So far, that has not worked.
And yet, both parties need to be looking at the Hispanic vote, which is growing in this country, and it seems to be breaking toward Democrats rather than Republicans. Is this something that Mitt Romney needs to look at carefully in the campaign?
Well, I urge your listeners to go to our website, nationaljournal.com. I had a long interview at a day-long session that National Journal sponsored last week called New America, looking at this exact question about the shifting demographics in America and how the Hispanic vote and the Latino influence on American culture, religion, economics, and politics is becoming a great and continuous story. And Marco Rubio, Republican senator, freshman from Florida, thought to be a rising star in the party, gave a very lengthy answer about the problems Republicans have and how they need to address them going forward. And he said, I'm going to come up with an alternative to the DREAM Act, but one bill is not going to solve this problem. There needs to be a continuous conversation Republicans have with this growing sector of the American community and get more comfortable with it and them more comfortable with Republicans. Because right now, if you look at the Republican Party voting patterns, it is consistently heavily white, heavily aged or aging, and less educated. That seems to be the demographic trend lines for the Republican Party. In most of the Republican primaries so far, with the exception of Arizona and Nevada, the white turnout was 90% or higher. And in the vast majority of Republican primaries, 60% or more of the voters who participated were 65 or older. That means it's an aging population, and it is an increasingly white population. Well, our country is younger and more diverse. So Republicans need to ask themselves, what do they do to adapt to this new demographic reality? And Senator Rubio had some very lengthy comments about that.
And why is it, you mentioned President Obama deporting so many people who are here illegally. Why hasn't that issue hurt him? It doesn't seem to have among Hispanic voters.
It rankles them a little bit, but the reason it hasn't hurt the president politically is because, broadly speaking, and this is comes up in the polling data pretty consistently, Hispanic voters, though not all of them, but in a broad majority, see the rhetoric and the positions taken by Republicans as so much more aggressive than what the president is doing. And the president's deportations have been, in large measure, cases that fall within the absolute legitimate deportation sort of category. He's not plucking people out of houses and just, but people who have been in the criminal process or near the criminal process, misdemeanors and other things like that, they're getting deported in numbers that they simply weren't before. So it's not a huge concern in the Hispanic community broadly. It would be if Republicans were saying nothing about immigration, but because their positions sound to many Latinos and Hispanics as strident or more strident than they're comfortable with. They're more fearful of that and more willing to give the president a break. And the president's a huge advocate of the DREAM Act and comprehensive reform, so they give him some slack on that as well.
And as you examine the federal immigration law, do you think that it pretty clearly preempts or disallows state regulations, or is there a lot of wiggle room?
You know, I'm not a constitutional scholar, and this is not an area of expertise for me as far as the way the federal courts and the Supreme Court historically have decided this question. I remember in the early 1990s going out to California where I was born. I was born in San Diego, and covering then-Governor Wilson's push for Proposition 187, which was an effort to cut off federal aid and state aid to illegal immigrants, because the governor said we have a huge immigration problem, it's draining our state budgets, and this is sort of a primal scream to get the federal government's attention to this immigration problem that we're having to cope with because they won't enforce border security. Well, federal court struck that down, even though it was passed by a referendum of 60-40. It was not a close vote in California on Proposition 187. And it's interesting, at the time, it wouldn't happen this year if that vote were to be taken. But back then, a majority of the Latinos who voted in that, a very small majority, but a majority nonetheless, supported Proposition 187. It had voter support, but the federal courts blocked it, and it was never implemented. So if you use that as sort of a litmus test, I think the federal government is, and the court system behind it, have been very skeptical of state interventions and have decided historically that the federal government is the lead governmental entity on border security, and that may be where this court comes down as well.
All right, let's move on to VPs. Why you think that the senator from Ohio, Rob Portman, is going to be Mitt Romney's vice presidential nominee?
Yes, well, again, another commercial here for National Journal. I write a column every week called All Powers, and I'm new to column writing. I've only done it for about 8 or 9 months. But what I've learned in that short period of time is that you have to provoke and explain. And everyone is going to guess about a vice presidential nominee. So I just said, the heck with guessing. Mitt Romney has not whispered in my ear, neither is Stuart Stevens, his top campaign advisor, or Ron Kaufman, or anyone in the Romney inner circle. I just know a lot about Mitt Romney and his decision-making process. I also know a lot about Rob Portman. And I think I have a feel for the issues, the way this campaign is going to be debated, and the things that, if he's elected, President-elect Romney is going to have to deal with. And by every measure, it seems to me there is only one person to pick, and that would be Rob Portman from Ohio.
And tell us a little bit, because I don't think he's very much on our
radar. He's not as well known. No. Here's a couple of things. First of all, Mitt Romney is not going to want any surprises. He doesn't want to waste any time with his vice presidential nominee. He doesn't want 2 weeks of surprise stories or revelation stories or things that are new to the American public. Rob Portman offers no risk there whatsoever. He's been confirmed by the Senate twice. He was budget director under President Bush and United States trade representative under President Bush. In the Senate now, he was elected in 2010. He served on the super committee that tried but failed to get $1.2 trillion in deficit reduction. He knows all the deficit numbers. He knows all the tax policy. He knows the politics of trade. He knows basically the politics, the policy of economics in this country, both domestically and internationally, as well as any potential running mate. He is, yes, on the boring side. But for Romney, that works because it doesn't create any sort of sense that he's reaching into the charisma pot of the Republican Party because he lacks it. Everyone knows he lacks charisma, and he's not going to be elected because he's charismatic or the most charismatic candidate. That's obvious. What he's going to be elected, if he's elected, is because he presents an alternative to the president and a managerial sense of competence that voters believe is worth taking a chance on. That's the only way that Mitt Romney is going to be elected, and he knows that. So I think he's going to do something that Bill Clinton did in 1992, reinforce the central message of his candidacy. Bill Clinton picked Al Gore, a Southerner, comparatively young, new approach to politics, a moderate, centrist, democratic approach to politics. He didn't go region. He didn't go charisma. He just went to reinforce. I think that's exactly what Mitt Romney is going to do. There are very few, almost no risks at all with Rob Portman, but you have core competency. No one in the national media will say he can't be president. No one will say he doesn't know what he's talking about. He's very well known within the constituencies that you need to be well known about to get off to a good start on a vice presidential campaign. And significantly, when Mitt Romney desperately needed a victory in Ohio, Rob Portman put his statewide organization into the mix hugely and did everything possible to ensure a Mitt Romney victory. And yes, Paul Ryan did the exact same thing in Wisconsin. And many of your listeners may say, well, many of the things you're saying about Senator Portman, you could say about Paul Ryan. I agree. But I think in the main, Rob Portman has worked harder, wants it more. And I think if Mitt Romney is thinking about being president, Rob Portman helps him in Ohio more than Paul Ryan can help him in Wisconsin. And a Republican is very hard-pressed to win the presidency without winning Ohio.
Mm, interesting. Let's talk about Afghanistan before we go to phone calls. Yesterday, this draft of a partnership agreement, troops leaving in 2014, American support, and I'm not sure what that support means, continuing until 2024, that's a long time from now.
That's a long time.
I can remember doing shows not all that long ago where some people were saying that Afghanistan could be the downfall of President Obama because it just hasn't been going very well. Do you see successes there, and what do you think is meant by support until 2024?
Well, here's the reason this agreement was signed. There is a desperate desire on the part of the U.S. government, President Obama, President Karzai in Afghanistan, to send a signal to the Taliban, to the Pakistani elements, or the elements within Pakistan, Taliban and otherwise, who wish U.S. and NATO forces plus the Afghan government ill and harm, that even though U.S. forces, after this spring offensive and this summer of fighting, will be withdrawing in considerable numbers, and all combat forces will be gone after 2014, the United States and Afghanistan will still remain strategic partners. They will still be involved with one another and still look out for one another. That's the large signal that's being sent. What does all that mean? Nobody really knows. No one can see this agreement. It was negotiated in private and remains in private. No one has seen the details, not in Afghanistan, not in Congress, not in the White House, and not publicly. Eventually, they will come out. Essentially, what the Afghans want is when the United States keeps some residual force after 2014 and in the interim as these combat operations continue, they want the United States to be less aggressive with night raids. They want the United States to give complete control to the holding of prisoners over to the Afghan government, and they want to shorten the duration of the amount of time U.S. and NATO forces can hold suspected terrorists in Afghanistan for interrogation. All these things are about the granular way of fighting a counterinsurgency war, and the United States is having to negotiate these things letter by letter with the Afghan government, even as public support for the Afghanistan war diminishes in the United States and those combat forces are going to be leaving. What the United States doesn't want to leave is the impression that it's a full-on bug out, that everything goes, and after 2014 you won't be able to find a U.S. or NATO ally anywhere in Afghanistan. What the United States is trying to signal is we're going to hang around.
We go to phone calls, and we'll take them momentarily. Our guest for all things political today is Major Garrett, White House correspondent for National Journal, spent a number of years at Fox News as White House correspondent, also was White House correspondent for CNN. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, our email address, talk@WPR.org, our Facebook address. Is this too many addresses? Is the Kathleen Dunn Show, so you can participate in a variety of ways. What are your thoughts about the Supreme Court and immigration? What do you think about Major's talk about who the possible, he thinks likely, vice presidential nominee will be? John Edwards, what a fall that guy has taken. We'll talk about that some this hour as well. And we have yet to talk about, is this a huge deal, the scandal involving the alleged misconduct of Secret Service officers? So all of that coming up, and we'll be with you in a minute, I promise, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during our 10 o'clock hour, Clint Hill will be joining us, Special Agent, United States Secret Service. His book is Mrs. Kennedy and Me. It's really a loving tribute to the years he spent as her primary Secret Service agent, and he was absolutely devastated by the assassination of John Kennedy and believes that he should have been able to save him. And lived with that and tortured himself over that for years and years and years. So he'll be with us tomorrow. All right, two phone calls now for all things political. Major Garrett, White House correspondent for National Journal, is our guest. And let's start our calls with Richard in Fort Atkinson. Hi, Richard.
Hello?
Hi, go right ahead.
Some of the comments of your guest, which are typical of many that one hears, make me nauseous. For example, you have commentators saying the Afghans want this, the Afghans want that, they want us to stay, they want us to provide security, and so on and so forth. When that really isn't true, what that really means is our puppet government there wants this and wants that. It wants protection to maintain its position while we continue our murderous policies year by year. Pretty soon, the war in Afghanistan will reach the comparison with the 30 years war between the Catholics and the Protestants in the 16th century. Certainly, Martin Luther King was correct when he said the United States is the greatest purveyor of violence in the world.
Major Garrett.
Well, let's see, where to begin. There are those in Congress who think there is a puppet-like relationship between the United States and the Karzai government in Kabul. There are some in Congress who believe that there is no puppet-like relationship, that Karzai is corrupt from head to toe and won't take any advice or counsel from the United States unless it benefits him or his cronies, and will take U.S. tax dollars and abuse them and use them to see things taken care of in exactly the way he wants, that he's not a fit partner, and we should, by those lights, get out of Afghanistan as soon as possible. These issues are being debated quite publicly in Congress. Some Republicans who had been long supporters of the Afghanistan war are now coming around to the idea that maybe this is something that ought to end sooner rather than later. The original commentary I made, or comments I gave, were about these negotiations about this strategic partnership. And I outlined that exactly as they're going on. The Karzai government, like it or not, is the one in charge in Afghanistan, to the degree that any government can be in charge in Afghanistan, which means it has some control over Kabul, a little bit less control in Kandahar, and not much control very many other places in Afghanistan, which is a tribal country with warlords or tribal lords that dominate regional areas and then exercise their own power within those regional areas and then compete for power as the regions either expand or contract. So I'm not an expert on Afghanistan history. I do take the caller's large point that some in Afghanistan don't want the United States or NATO there any longer. That's certainly true. The Karzai government, as it's currently constructed, does, and is the negotiating partner and the only negotiating partner President Obama has to deal with right now.
Let's go to Jim in Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I want to talk mainly about the state's rights issue, but I'll just say as a quick aside while I was listening, no disrespect intended to the guest, that you know, the idea that Mitt Romney has competence to judge my life or the average person that's listening's life is silly when you put it in the context of a guy who wants to put a car elevator in a house in Malibu. Now, on the immigration and states' rights issue, I think it just comes down to whose ox is being gored. There's no consistency coming from the conservatives. They want states' rights in terms of immigration, but it's interesting that in 2007, Rick Wagner, then head of GM, was opposing states' rights in terms of gas mileage because he said that California's was too standard for the gas mileage was too high. And then in November of 2008, he switched gears because GM was in financial problems and went to Congress and begged for money to be able to increase gas mileage. So it just depends on whose ox is being gored. There's no consistency from the conservative point of view on this.
Oh, totally valid points, especially on mileage standards in states. I grew up in California. California's been among the most aggressive, if not the most aggressive state in pushing those. And the auto companies with allies, Democrat and Republican, at the time opposed those, saying that there had to be a federal standard because if you didn't have a federal standard, the auto companies could not respond and could not produce a sufficient number of vehicles for the selected markets in which the gas mileage requirements were substantially higher than the federal standard. There's some justification for that. I would not say that's entirely analogous to the immigration situation. But if you're talking about pure consistency on states' rights, that would be an inconsistency. I take the caller's point. And as far as what Mitt Romney's, remember, I'm not saying Mitt Romney is competent. I'm saying he's going to campaign on competency. Voters like Jim and those like him across the country will decide whether or not Mitt Romney is competent. I'm just going to say that he's going to tell you that he is. You decide yourself.
A lot has been said the last week, particularly, that this whole election revolves around the economy. And if things go a little bit more sour in the next few months, this is Mitt Romney's election. If things perk up a little bit, the president will be reelected. Is that true, do you think?
That's broadly true, but that's almost always broadly true. There have been very few elections in this country settled by an issue other than the economy. Yes, you can have wedge issues on the side when the economy is really, really going well. But even when it's going really well, if it's going really well, those wedge issues tend not to dominate. Republicans tried that in 1996 with Bill Clinton. He won. Democrats tried it in 1984 with Ronald Reagan. The perception of the economy in both those reelection years was the economy was not only good but getting better and likely to continue to get better. Ronald Reagan won handily. Bill Clinton won handily. When George Herbert Walker Bush ran in 1992, though the recession of 1991 was over as a matter of economic statistics, the country still felt the economy was not good and were uncertain whether or not it would get better, and therefore he lost. So it's always true to say the economy is dominant. I think the other issues or the other aspects of this election are going to be underneath the economy, which is President Obama is going to say, I won a historic election in 2008. I promised a lot of things about politics, and I delivered on them. I promised you a more aggressive federal effort on regulating Wall Street. I passed a law to do that. I promised you I would campaign for and try to get health care reform as broadly defined and as universal in access as I could possibly achieve it. I've done that. I told you I would appoint certain kind of justices, the Supreme Court. I've done that. Many of the things I promised, I have accomplished. And so I'm running not just on the economy, but on my pact with you, the American public, who elected me in 2008. I did what I said I was going to do, and on that basis, you should reelect me. What Mitt Romney's going to say is he did all the things he said that he was going to do, or many of them. They haven't worked out as well as they should. I have a better set of alternatives, and if you're dissatisfied, not that the president didn't do what he said he did, but the result of the things he said he would do, then vote for me. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be another element of this.
The Times had an interesting piece on Saturday, perhaps you saw it, looking at what's happened in various states, that there have been social issues front and center, teaching evolution, abortions, abstinence education, et cetera. Let me quote from the article, some Republican strategists and officials who didn't want to be identified say that the party's attention to these divisive social issues are receiving at the state level could harm the party's chances in November. They want the conversation to be focused on the economy. Do you think there's truth in that?
Probably, although it cuts both ways. And I would say the politics on these quote-unquote divisive social issues can be mixed. Let us go back to the 2004 election, President Bush against John Kerry. On many state ballots, I can't remember the number, but it was, I think, approaching 20. The question of gay marriage was a referendum question in the November ballot. Many Republicans and many Democrats, probably more Democrats than Republicans, believe that pumped up Republican turnout in a way that was helpful to President Bush. It was certainly true that it helped boost turnout in Ohio, the state that turned out to be pivotal in George Bush defeating John Kerry. But turnout was also up, and up by a much larger percentage, in two states that didn't have gay marriage on the ballot, Iowa and New Mexico. The Bush-Cheney campaign boosted their vote totals in both those states, took those states away from Democrats in 2004, and that was also part of the matrix. So some places these issues can play to the Republican base and create more turnout. Some places where they don't exist, you can still do it the old-fashioned way, by turnout models, voter contact, and all sorts of other things. So I think what Republicans would like to do this election is downplay what they might fear are either Tea Party-inspired or heavily socially conservative-inspired issues at the state level that appear to independent voters or undecided voters as too much, as over the top.
Mm-hmm.
Because if that is accompanying what Mitt Romney's trying to do, then it will complicate the overall Republican message, and that could harm them come the fall.
We have lines open now if you've been trying to get through. The number is 800-486-8655. You can also use an email, talk@WPR.org. Joanne in Milwaukee, hi.
Good morning, Kathleen, and good morning to your guests. You brought up Ohio and the importance of that in the election. In that, you also brought up Wisconsin, and I wonder what your guest sees as the implications of the recall election that's going to happen here in Wisconsin in June. Well, first in May to see who the Democratic candidate will be, and then in June when we have a recall election with our Republican governor. What kind of national implications will this election have?
Well, I don't want to sound glib or cynical, but the first implication will be a lot of money will be spent on both questions, and they already have been. Money was spent on the underlying legislative recall elections as well. And money spent in May and June is money that cannot be spent in September, October, and November. And I know that sounds almost overwhelmingly cynical, but it's a reality. And political money counts. And the availability of political money counts. And Republicans will spend money and Democrats will spend money. And so they're going to use resources on very high-profile races. It's very important for Republicans to defend Governor Walker, very important for Democrats to knock him out, to put together a good nominee and put together a successful recall campaign. All of that will take money out of the system nationally, because it's not just going to be, as I'm telling you something you don't already know, it's not just a Wisconsin issue. Of course it's not just a Wisconsin issue. Money pours in from the nation for these races, which means you can't spend that in September, October, and November. The other issue will be, what do Republicans and Democrats take away from what, and I don't want to speak out of turn here, but it seems like almost a trench warfare feeling in Wisconsin about the underlying legislative seats and the governor and his ability to stay in office or be ousted from office. What do state politicians, what do federal politicians take from all this? Do they take away that Scott Walker, if he's successful and beats back the recall, that you can survive, that you can build a coalition, that you can use outside money and defend yourself if you take on big issues? Or if he loses, is the message, forget about this. This pension reform thing, however defined and however carried out, is a complete loser. Stay away from it, because if you touch it, you're going to die. Those are all the things that are going to be looked at and sifted as a result of these elections in the summer and spring.
Thank you, Joanne, very much for your call. Email from Diane in Mishicata, who writes, many Americans relate the Bush administration to the severe economic recession. In choosing a running mate from the Bush administration, Romney may be doing the Democrats a favor. Is that the risk in choosing Portman, that he served in the Bush administration?
Sure. That is probably the only risk that I can see, and I address that in my column. I just think it is outweighed, or it is minimal compared to the other either positives or non-negatives. And looking at Rob Portman's involvement in the Bush administration, you have 2 one-year terms. 1 year as U.S. Trade Representative, and there's nothing controversial about his tenure there whatsoever. And I actually believe for any future role in a presidential cabinet or in the vice presidency, you'd be hard-pressed to find a job better than United States Trade Representative, because you become intimately familiar with everything involved in the U.S. economy, everything that it exports, everything we import, and you also learn about the intricate economic politics in nations with which we negotiate treaties. And that is not just those we are negotiating treaties with presently, but everyone that falls under the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs, GATT, or the World Trade Organization. I mean, it is a dossier in world global politics and world global economics and how they relate to America's domestic economy. So Rob Portman did that for a year and a half, and he was budget director for 1 year. And most of the decisions that Democrats believe were most harmful to the budget and fiscal health of this country were made when Mitch Daniels was budget director, not Rob Portman. So other people think, well, what about Mitch Daniels from Indiana, the governor there? Well, if you put Mitch Daniels on the ticket, you're going to have to revisit every single early decision made by President Bush on tax cuts, on the Medicare Part D drug benefit that was not paid for, the Iraq war that wasn't paid for, all those issues much more central to Mitch Daniels' role as budget director than Rob Portman's.
Mm. Let's talk a little bit about the Secret Service. I spent a good chunk of the weekend reading Clint Hill's book, Mrs. Kennedy and Me, and it's really a very moving tribute to what that profession is and how hard it is and the sacrifices that Secret Service agents make. And, of course, he was on duty during one of the more horrendous incidents in American history.
Yes.
But yeah, I'm wondering about this whole scandal, Major Garrett. What do you think of it? Is it worth our paying very serious attention to? Are there secrets that could have been shared that could have been harmful? Are we making too much of it?
I don't think we're making too much of it. And I must tell you, Kathleen, I am stunned. I am absolutely flabbergasted by this scandal.
Really?
And the reason I am. And that's a hard thing for me to say, having lived in Washington for 22 years.
Right.
And here's the reason. I've covered three different presidents on a continuous basis. When you cover a president of the United States on a continuous basis, you are by definition in the company of and in the protective security of the Secret Service. And they have been, to a man and woman, the finest people I've ever encountered in American law enforcement. Mm-hmm. And I was a police reporter for 6 years in three newspapers around this country when I was working my way through the low minor leagues of American newspaper journalism. And this episode in Cartagena, Colombia, and I've traveled with President Clinton to Cartagena, Colombia, in 2000.
Oh, really?
So I've not been to the Hotel Caribe, but I've been to Cartagena. I've been with Secret Service. I've traveled the world with these agents, and I've traveled the world with them as providing Secret Service protection for presidential candidates. And this level of recklessness and operational security breaching. You cannot, if you're a part of an advance team, you cannot allow strangers into your room, period. And you can't allow them into the presidential hotel. And the 12th person now implicated, who's on administrative leave of the Secret Service, was booked at the Hilton, the president's hotel. Caribe was where the advance team was. That's bad enough. But anything that gets within any proximity of the presidential hotel creates the potential of operational security hazards in a place, let us remind ourselves, Colombia is not just any other country. It is a country that for decades has been rife with all sorts of wildcat violence left and right. When I was with President Clinton in 2000, there was a bomb attempt, unsuccessful, but there was nevertheless a bomb attempt on his presidential limousine.
Mm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
There were two explosions outside the U.S. Embassy the morning President Obama arrived in Cartagena. Okay? Operational security questions are enormous. And the trauma of anything inflicted on the presidency of the United States, the collective trauma felt globally and felt in this country, is, as Clint writes in his book, life-shattering.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Something happens to the president, it is a cathartic moment for the country. It's the maximum job in the federal government, the maximum job, protecting the president and protecting everything around the president and making sure that there is no way that anyone who wants to do ill to this country or wants to do ill to the presidency even suspects that they can worm their way in. And a scandal like this creates a global impression that you can worm your way in, that you can break inside the security perimeter. You can get agents to do things that could compromise them or that could compromise security or at minimum, could make them easy subjects and targets for blackmail.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just astonished by it.
Mm. So what do we do about it?
Well, you apply maximum accountability. And I can't remember. I think the number is now up to 6 Secret Service agents who are now gone, whose careers are ended, finished. And then you see if after having established that, if there are legitimate means by which to prosecute this, and if there are crimes committed against U.S. law or Colombian law, but U.S. law first, then prosecute them. Because you have to send a signal that this is absolutely intolerable and that the consequences are life-changing and life-altering if you do this. Because if you don't, then you get a culture where maybe this is a bit acceptable, and it simply can't be. It simply cannot be acceptable.
We'll take more phone calls. We're talking this hour of all things political with Major Garrett, White House correspondent for National Journal. He has covered many presidencies. He was before at National Journal. He was at Fox News. He was a White House correspondent for CNN, covering Presidents Bush and President Clinton, senior editor and congressional correspondent for U.S. News and World Report. He's spent, I think he said, 22 years in Washington covering people and activities at the very top. More phone calls momentarily. Our lines are filled right now, but keep the number in your head, 800-486-8655. You can also post your comments on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program this Monday, the editors of Scholastic Magazine asked literacy experts and moms, actually, around the country to come up with a list of their favorite children's books. And they have compiled a list of 100 of the best children's books. We're going to talk about what's on that list and hear from you, too, about your favorite children's book. I think mine is Charlotte's Web, and it's on the list. Thank goodness. I think that's Rhonda's, and we have yet to ask Brett what his favorite children's book is. So we'll talk about that. We love talking about books on this show and children's books in particular. So we're going to have some fun. Let's go back to phone calls. Lay, is it, in Caledonia? Or
Hi.
Lee?
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
We learned today in the Milwaukee Journal that most of the voters in Wisconsin are either Democratic or Republican, very few independents. And I'm wondering if the nation is becoming very polarized in terms of, are there very few people that are still kind of on the fence or anyway, I'm interested in your thoughts on this. Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
It's a fascinating question, and I wish I could give you an absolute answer. Let me give you two perspectives on this question. I had a long conversation in New York a week and a half ago with Joel Benenson, who is President Obama's pollster. He was his pollster in 2008. He's going to be his pollster in 2012. I've had a similar conversation with some prominent Republican pollsters, Ed Goez among them, Clint Bolick. And if you look at the way voters identify themselves, what they tell pollsters they are, 41% identify themselves in the most recent Gallup survey as independents, the highest percentage of self-identified independents in American history. That means they're all independents, right? Actually, it doesn't. What it means is that's what they've told pollsters they are. But the parties know that there are many independents who identify themselves that way who, even so, tend to vote more in alignment with one party or another. In other words, they are Republican-leaning independents or Democratic-leaning independents. And it doesn't take all that much persuading to get the Republican-leaning independents to predictably vote Republican and the Democratic-leaning independents to predictably vote Democratic. There are probably, in this country, 8, 9, maybe 12% max, absolutely pure independents who really will, election to election, vote differently in congressional or presidential elections. And you can have big shifts even among Republican-leaning and Democratic-leaning independents. Let me give you an example. In 2006, those who identified themselves as independents voted for Democrats for Congress by 18 percentage points over Republicans. So the independents went heavily for the Democrats. That's why they won control of Congress in 2006, taking it away from Republicans. In 2010, those who identified themselves as independents voted for Republicans 19 percentage points higher than they did in 2006. So they swung back in the other direction. So you can have sways both on the Republican and Democratic side or across an entire continuum. So it's a complicated question to answer. You're going to hear people like me and commentators and pundits on the air for months now talking about the independents. Well, what does that mean? Pollsters will tell you it means many are aligned with the Republican Party, many are aligned with the Democratic Party, and in big years when there's tremendous either hostility to one party or another, they can shift. But as far as pure independents, the percentage is about 8 to 12%.
Thanks for the call. Willem in Colfax. Hi.
I was just wondering what the guest thinks about the sort of takeover of the Republican Party. I read today in the paper about Orrin Hatch, and it seems like I guess the reason they don't like him is they feel like he's compromised too much. And it seems to me that at every turn, the Republicans are becoming more radically right-wing socially. You know, I'm using very divisive social issues with a combination of the money from big oil and other interests to deny climate change, and cooking up this combination that doesn't seem to me to represent anything that the Republican Party used to represent, like, you know, the Eisenhower Republicans or Teddy Roosevelt Republicans, or certainly Abraham Lincoln Republicans. Abraham Lincoln said there is no capital without labor. I don't think any Republican today would say that.
Major Garrett.
An interesting question. Let me deal with the Orrin Hatch part of it first, and I'll get to the philosophical part of it second. The Orrin Hatch story is actually more nuanced than perhaps the headlines suggested this weekend. Yes, he did not win in the convention in Utah and will have to face a primary, but he fell just short, literally within a margin of a few votes at the convention, of getting the 60% necessary to avoid a primary. And what that tells me, and what it told Republicans in Utah, is two things. One, Hatch ran a much better campaign, and there was much higher turnout of more what you would call establishment Republicans at that Utah Republican convention than there was 2 years ago, when Orrin Hatch's Republican colleague Robert Bennett came in third and was knocked out of the Senate by Tea Party-inspired participants in that Republican nominating convention in Utah. The turnout then was very low, dominated entirely by the Tea Party, and a sitting senator was completely knocked out of office as a result. This had much higher turnout, much more establishment Republicans, but the caller is right about one thing. To get to near 60%, Orrin Hatch in the last year and a half has taken much more aggressively conservative positions to prevail either in that convention, which he fell just short of, or to win in the primary, which you'll have to do later on this year. So he's gone hard right to ingratiate himself, but he also had the support of more establishment Republicans who did not want to lose the seniority that Utah enjoyed with Orrin Hatch, who's been in the Senate for nearly six terms. Now, the broader philosophical question, are there Teddy Roosevelt Republicans? No. Richard Nixon Republicans? No, Richard Nixon created the Environmental Protection Agency. There are some who believe there aren't even any Ronald Reagan Republicans left. Ronald Reagan did several things when he was president that would be described by free market economists and Republicans, and they were then and would be now as protectionist. Let us recall what President Reagan did to protect Harley-Davidson. He imposed import quotas on Japanese bicycles, motorcycles, because he said they were unfairly undercutting the price of Harley-Davidson. And to protect that U.S. company, its brand name and its employees, Ronald Reagan did something that would be regarded by free market Republican capitalists as anathema. He erected trade barriers and did not allow free trade to continue. Would that be necessarily the quote-unquote industrial policy of the modern Republican Party? Maybe yes, maybe no. I think there are those who look at the Republican Party, particularly in the Northeast United States, maybe in the upper Midwest, and say there's less and less in this party I recognize. Quite clearly, if you look at the Republican Party and where its core strength is, it is Southern and Western. It is not nearly any longer Northeastern and upper Midwest. That's going to be a complicating factor for Mitt Romney. And I think it's one of the reasons he had a hard time sealing the deal to win the nomination, because he's Northeastern and, generally speaking, more moderate in his approach to politics, at least when he was governor of Massachusetts.
Thanks, Willem, very much for the call. Let's spend a moment, some would say that's probably all he's worth, on John Edwards, who's back in court. What does John Edwards' story tell us? And are we going to pay a lot of attention to this trial?
The political community will pay a lot of attention to it, and those who were fascinated by the John Edwards phenomenon will pay close attention to it. What it tells us is there are real risks to being a pathological liar. Mm-hmm. And in this one segment of John Edwards' life, he was a pathological liar. Not everywhere, not on policy, not on everything he did or everything he touched. I'm not suggesting that. But in this area of his life, dealing with things that he knows in politics are both politically sensitive and important on the question of either values or morality or judgment. Pick the three. You can put all three together, or you can just take one of those three. But if you're running for the presidency of the United States, and if you're a running mate for somebody, as he was in 2004 with John Kerry, you have to take one or all three of them very seriously. And in this sector of his life, he didn't. And not only did he implicate himself with his dishonesty, he implicated someone else in having them use allegedly, this is what the documents and the court say, another person in the fundraising community of the John Edwards to pay off somebody to hush up this illicit affair. And the paper trail appears pretty clear. His culpability appears pretty clear, certainly enough to charge him, certainly enough to bring an indictment. And he's going to have to face the repercussions of that. I just think it's – which is worth noting that he was a very successful politician. I watched him campaign in two presidential campaigns in Iowa and all over this country. Spent many days in Wisconsin covering the 2004 primaries. And John Edwards had a real aura about him. People wanted to believe him. They listened to him raptly. He was very successful at that. And I guess it's just one cautionary tale that about politicians – you can never be sure, and they can have these parts of their lives that are secret but nevertheless pathological that can come back to haunt them.
Mm. Major Garrett, thank you so much for being with us this hour. I enjoyed it.
It's been a great pleasure. I hope we can do it again.
Well, absolutely. We will. Major Garrett, our guest this hour for All Things Political, White House correspondent for National Journal, former for many years, reporter for Fox News. He also was White House correspondent for CNN. Thanks to Brett Jaspers for producing this hour, and thanks to Brett Jaspers for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios. We have news coming up shortly, and then we'll talk about our all-time favorite children's books. We're going to have a very good time. This is the Ideas Network.